So we might start. Well, look, welcome to this fascinating session to hear expert insights about the Royal Commission. I know we're all taking a keen interest in this one. Unfortunately, Rowena Orr couldn't make it, so I will be doing the interrogating today. Look, we've got a full hour of questions here, so I would really encourage you, and if we can have the SMS number up here, to start getting your questions in early. You know, it gives you a great opportunity to ask what you want to hear answered. So please get your questions in early. There's also going to be electronic polling to address audience reaction to issues raised. So if I can also ask you to open up your apps and look at the two questions for this session, and please start answering. So just, I guess I would like to start just with hands up, everybody, who thought the Royal Commission would create this much disruption. Who foresaw it? Yeah, a few hands, but maybe not the full audience, certainly. So look, a great many people said that the Royal Commission would prove very little, but in fact the ramifications of the evidence heard will be substantial. It feels like there's been a real paradigm shift. Consumer expectations are really being brought to the forefront. So we've got a great panel here today. Obviously, their full bios are on the app, but just to give you a bit of a brief introduction, we have Michael Vrizakis, and he's over 30 years' experience in the financial services, recognised expert in the area of non-contentious regulation, and is regularly nominated a leading legal practitioner in this space, and quotes from the financial press. We have Anthony Asher, who you will know is an associate professor with the University of New South Wales Business School. And Anthony believes that the actuarial profession fulfills its social role by creating financial security for people. So he's taking very much an ethics consideration today. And Paul Howes is a partner at KPMG, national sectors leader for wealth management, but also the partner in charge of KPMG's customer, brand and marketing advisory practice, specializing in assisting clients to transform their organizations into more customer-centric ones. But, of course, you'll also know him from his previous experience of 15 years in the Australian labour movement. So please welcome everybody. So, look, I'd just like to kick it off, I guess, ask everybody, has the Royal Commission been a good thing? Do you think it was overdue? And also just to ask you, you know, your particular angle of where you'd want to come, you know, where you're coming from in this panel today. So, Michael, maybe I can kick off with you.
I think the Royal Commission has been a good thing. I mean, I think it's brought to the fore a lot of issues that perhaps had not been recognised or realised. That being said, I think it's raised some very interesting questions about the conduct standards, in particular community expectations, which is one thing I want to touch on. I get a lot of queries from people as to where the regulation is going to go and what it might be some of the concrete outcomes of the Commission. So I think there's a bit of crystal ball gazing to some extent about exactly how this is going to translate into additional measures, regulatory measures. How does community expectations play in that? Mm-hmm. I think also from my perspective, and I think from a lot of other people's perspectives, very much related to some of the other activity that we're seeing, particularly the APRA culture review, and how does that then fit into a Royal Commission context, particularly around accountability mapping and responsibility of roles. So just to fly back to your initial question, I think that the approach of going to the industry and saying, what problems have you experienced, bringing those out is not just cathartic. I'm sure people wouldn't necessarily think it was cathartic if they're in the Commission itself, but it is one of the ways in which efficiency is brought into a system through that sort of condensed and distilled process of analytically looking at, in a very, albeit short time frame, but a very concentrated way, what are those issues.
Well, people have said, I think, that some of the material that's coming out, people knew already.
Yeah.
But it just seems that the Royal Commission means that there's real focused attention and that those messages are getting out to the broader public, whereas previously they weren't.
I think one thing I would finish before you pass the other speakers is just trust. Yeah. And the trust component to this, and what role does a Royal Commission have in restorative role in terms of the trust equation, which is obviously incredibly important.
Mm-hmm. Paul, over to you.
Well, I think the Royal Commission was inevitable, and whether it occurred when it was called or whether it occurred in 2 or 3 years' time, it was going to happen. I know that it's popular now to say that it is a good thing for the industry. I'm sceptical about that, and I'm sceptical still about whether in the long term it will end up being a good process for consumers and for the sector. Because what Royal Commissions do, and they're difficult processes to go through. Unfortunately, I've been through a few. You can't really, as an institution under investigation in an NRC, win. It is not a court case. It is not a matter of having a verdict. A commission generally will take to air instances that prove a broader point in trying to achieve a regulatory or recommended outcome. So if an institution is called before an RC, you don't have that opportunity to say, well, look at the full gamut of what we do, understand what the difference between maybe a isolated incident to a systemic issue is, and how do you actually properly air that. And I advised a number of clients in the lead up to the commission, people that were opposed to it and people that were in favour of it, be careful what you wish for. And I think it'll be interesting to talk a little bit today about the superannuation industry. Of course, we haven't seen the focus on industry funds yet, but it is, of course, within the terms of reference. We haven't seen the focus on the role of super in SMSFs and retail funds as well. But I think that will lead to some pretty interesting airing of issues that exist within that sector, which are often not getting the same level of coverage that the retail banking sector gets. And I think that as a whole, as a society, when we are dealing with these complex issues of ultimately, and I agree with Michael, the issue of trust and how you rebuild trust, we have to be cautious of not encouraging policymakers to run with big, blunt instruments to try to rebuild that trust with institutions. Mm-hmm. I think ultimately time will tell whether I'm wrong or not on whether this has been a good outcome for us. But I think already we are seeing potential unintended consequences of what the Commission is heading to. Of course, we haven't seen their recommendations, but it isn't hard to draw some conclusions from at least Council Assisting's submissions and, of course, even the Commissioner himself's questions.
Yeah, where they might go. Anthony, did you think it was needed?
I'm not sure. I don't know whether Royal Commission is the right approach to it, but I think it's an opportunity. I think there's actually what's made it very clear is there's lots in the industry that is not attractive, and I think it should be an opportunity for us all, particularly within the industry, to reflect on what's gone wrong and what our role is. Mm-hmm. I don't think we do a good job of providing financial security and allocating capital, and I think this is providing a lens to look at that. And if we use the opportunity, great. Mm-hmm. If it turns out to the more regulation and more of the same, it would be an opportunity wasted.
Mm-hmm. So, Michael, I guess I'd like to ask, are community expectations around, you know, this idea of acting efficiently, honestly and fairly the new standard of conduct?
I think it's kind of like a famous Bob Dylan song that you're probably familiar with yourself. The times are changing. I think the laws are changing. And I think that some of the lyrics of that song are probably appropriate about swimming or sinking. But the reality is that community expectations is an interesting lens. And to go back to some of the previous comments, it's a hard lens in some ways because it's very fluid. Mm. The law changes. The law is affected by community expectations. Community expectations are built into the way in which judges decide cases, the way in which statutes are made. But to see community expectations being presented live time is quite interesting. I think personally the way in which the Commissioner has talked about legal conduct and then community expectations is itself very interesting. Community expectations will no doubt influence the way some of the existing legal concepts such as efficiently, honestly and fairly, good faith, are going to be interpreted. The question is really, what is the appropriate forum for that to happen? Should that be left to the courts? Should the regulators, are the regulators going to take more expansive views of those things? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think some of the things too in the commission play out legally, as legally sound. Certain things were legally sound, but the next question is, you've got to ask then the next question, which is, do they meet community expectations?
Mm-hmm. And I guess, are community expectations realistic? I sometimes wonder, you know, the expectations we have of our politicians, you know, our organisations, when we all know what can be achieved in a day, it's an interesting, you know, do we need to bridge that gap between what's possible? Speak more honestly about that.
The hard thing is when you're judged by community expectations, when there's been legal standards that people thought were the compass within which and to which people should operate mm-hmm. in the sector. And then to have an overlay of community expectations really puts a ethical, certainly, and that's absolutely legitimate, a moral, which is legitimate,
yes.
and also I suppose it puts into play the prioritisation of customers' interests. The real question is, the difficult question is, balancing shareholder interests
yes.
and the interests of a particular financial services sector with the interests of the community. And that's always going to be quite fluid and
yep.
oftentimes hard to get that balance right.
Yeah. Now there's some things that certainly just don't meet community expectations. So, and that's come out in the Royal Commission.
It's very easy, might I say, to judge that by the stuff that is flagrantly wrong.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And we're seeing some of that now. Paul, any views on that?
Yeah, it's a good question because I don't really know what community expectations means. And this is one of the issues around the terms of reference. Australia is a community, but there's lots of different communities. And it's like, I had a client the other day say to me, do you reckon this will pass the pub test, Paul? And I said, well, maybe in the pub that you drink at, but there's lots of different pubs in lots of different communities. And you know, one of the great things about leaving politics and joining KPMG is that, you know, this kind of vexed issue of how you satisfy such a large section of the population isn't something that I worry about as much as I used to.
Yeah.
Because I think at the end of the day, community expectations when it comes to financial services will contradict themselves. People expect and have expectations of a strong, secure, robust financial services industry, particularly around banking.
Mm-hmm.
And Australians were proud, and research showed that, very proud of the way in which our financial services industry weathered the global financial crisis. But there is also expectations that levels of executive remuneration and ROI for a number of these institutions should be lower. Which, of course, one does tend to contradict the other. People will want greater diversification and competition in services, but stronger and more trusted institutions. Again,
yeah.
Things that contradict each other. And even if you look at some of the polling and research, and, you know, my practice does a lot of this at KPMG, when you look at the research of customer expectations around banking, you know, there is overwhelming agreement amongst the community that there is something wrong in the banking sector. But generally, most banking customers are happier with the services that their bank provides them than, say, what their telco provides them, or their utilities provider provides them, or their transport provider provides them. The actual customer satisfaction ratings for individual customers of these banks are actually quite high compared to other non-financial services section of the economy. And so I think we've got to be really careful about making two blanket statements around community expectations, because it is actually the role of policymakers to work through these contradictions and come out with the best consensus outcome for our society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look, I think we'll go back to that later, because it obviously has implications internationally as well about how our financial services is viewed in terms of raising capital. Just, Anthony, can you legislate for ethics?
All right. Okay, that's the question. Like, guys, you're far too smug. Will not do. The system is not working remotely near universal standards of justice. There is a huge amount of overcharging and overservicing within the financial services industry. People, you know, the people are out there bluffing their shareholders, bluffing their boards, bluffing their shareholders, extracting profits and revenue from their clients in ways that are unjust on an objective fashion, and the Royal Commission will find that, and some of them will go to court. It's just we're way below where we want to be.
Yeah.
So can you regulate
yeah.
ethics? The answer is yes, but you can't expect too much from it. Firstly, that ethics, you can, the codes of conduct that we've got, the law that we've got, set a standard of law and ethics. You don't steal, you don't cheat, you don't lie to people, you keep your contracts. But those are aspirations that are set by the community as a whole. And they've got to speak to the good spirit within us. We all are responsible for ensuring that those standards are met. You cannot ask the regulators to do that, because if you ask the regulators to do it all, they start punishing people more and more and more and more, and you end up with, as they're doing in the States, 20% of the large proportion of the population in jail. We've all got to say, these are the standards that we accept. The regulators have a role, not in enforcing the standards, but in punishing those that move towards the edge, so that they, in a sense, like sheepdogs, they crowd us towards the better angle. I'd say there are two areas where regulation can particularly help. The first is, well, they both relate to temptations. So the problem, you know, you've learned economics, you've learned nothing about psychology, and probably thought very little about we have in our lives. We think much too little about human frailty. Deliver us from temptation. The two temptations in the industry, particularly, are to greed and to power. The temptation to greed is addressed in law historically by prohibiting conflicts of interest. Okay, you should not be put in a position where your interests and your duty conflict. Because if you do, as the good judge said in 1896, human nature being what it is you'll favor your interests. It is possible legally to override this general law prohibition of conflicts of interest. And we have legally, perhaps sometimes I think the commission will find not so legally in some instances, we've legally allowed people to have conflicts of interest. The CIS Act and the Corpus Act both allow conflicts of interest. They've got to be managed. 2,000 years of equity, 1,000 years of equity, effectively say they can't. We've got to get that temptation, we've got to, as much as possible, take that temptation out of the industry so people have a very clear relationship with the person that they're serving and they're not conflicted. The second is more difficult. How do you address the temptation to power and to arrogance? Now, we have, and this is where the expectations, I think, of high salaries have come to a stake. It's known. You call it the hubris syndrome. It's a psychological problem. If you have power for too long, you begin to lose touch with reality. I don't know for those of you who have been to Elizabeth Sheedy's session, or is it coming later? Mm-hmm. She talks about the rose-tinted spectacles that she finds under most senior management. They lost touch with reality. Because when you're being paid, $10 million a year, and the people that come to you are being paid $100,000, the power relationship is huge. And it's impossible to contradict a guy in that position. So what we need is to structure the organizations in such a way that the directors have, I think we need directors with independent sources of power. So minority voting, minority representation of shareholders, possibly even unions on the board as they have in Europe, where the hierarchies are much flatter. But certainly ways of making sure that hierarchy, that extra power is flattened, and preferably split the banks up so they have less power. Because basically the people at the top cannot see their problems. They're too isolated. They've lost the battle against arrogance.
Please jump in, guys, if you have a contradictory view.
And I generally like to respond to when I'm being called smug. And of course, I love being called smug by academics. But of course, absolutely right. The industry has, for far too long, particularly post the GFC period, written on their own hubris about what they achieved in some of those periods. And I was one of those people that argued against it at the time. I can see some odd sparring partners in the audience on some of these points. You know, one of the reasons why, you know, we created Australian Super and why I was very proud to serve on that board for so long is because we thought, as a movement, when I was active in the Labor movement, that we needed to create diversification. And it was a deliberate strategy to look at how we actually ensured that there was a financial services industry that had other elements in it. But when you get into the nitty-gritty and you think about the impact that potential regulatory changes will have in the short term on the lives of average Australians, it's important for us to step out and have a think about knee-jerk reactions to broader problems. And I think the Royal Commission, and considering the terms of reference, were drafted in a matter of hours in response to an issue regarding Section 44 of the Constitution and the numbers that existed in the House that particular month. That is the definition of knee-jerk, okay? And that is exactly where we landed. Now, the government today is backpedalling and saying they were right to call it. And frankly, I think a more pragmatic government in the previous times would have called it earlier just to get the issue off the table. Mm-hmm. But I want to pose you this question. In the United States at the moment, the average mortgage approval period is 6 weeks. In Australia, it's 3 days. Now, why is it in the United States? It's because of the regulatory requirement for greater human intervention around that. Is that a scenario that we want to play out? The European Works Councils, which you just referred to under EU legislation, is a great example. Now, did the European Works Councils' participation on the board of the Dutch banks in the lead-up to 2008 save them? No. Mm-hmm. Did it cross issues? So, for take example, the Volkswagen scandal that happened there. Who was the chairman of Volkswagen when that was happening? Mm-hmm. Berthold Huber, the president of the single largest trade union in the world, IG Metall. You know, there are, I think at the moment, we are often creating answers and solutions in search of a problem. We have a fundamental issue in the Australian financial services industry of broken trust between consumers and the community. But I think we need to take a more pragmatic and long-term approach to how we find the answers to these questions, because policy on the run always creates unintended consequences down the track.
Michael.
I probably find myself wrongly positioned in this debate. I should have been between...
Yeah.
I could have had a role to actually referee and potentially talking about conflicts, manage those conflicts. I'd like to think that in terms of what Paul, if I may defend Paul as well, since we're in the collective smug categorisation. I prefer
this,
to say...
This is a very, very scary position for me to be defended by a Free Hills partner.
I'm happy to do it on a pro bono basis.
I've lost all cred now.
But I would say that it was more succinct than smug. But I think... But we may disagree on that. I think, though, from the point of view of how lawyers look at this, this is a continuum, which I think you've got to recognise that we have a need for certainty. I don't think we can just leap into this lava pool of kind of very, very fluid and unknown standards. Mm. I look at it very much from the point of view of certainty of standards, as I think a lot of people in the industry would look at it. And governance and accountability are things that will happen not just because of the Commission. They're going to happen around the Commission, culture reviews and things like that. And let's not forget, too, we've got other forums in which people can ventilate issues. I'm not saying they're perfect, but through complaints, systems, etc. So I'd prefer to look at this as a continuum rather than just saying that we're in a, you know, no doubt there are tectonic changes. I think we need to focus, including in this session, around the impact on vertical integration. Yeah. But I do think, to Anthony's earlier point, I don't think that we are miles apart in terms of philosophy about what a good system should be, or the values certainly that you espouse. But financial services have been singled out. Let's not forget that either.
Yeah.
I mean, there are other industries which I won't name, which a very, very different level of conduct is applied to, far less stringent. And you might recognise it too in the Royal Commission. Banks were singled out as occupying a special position of trust based on presumably the enormity of the of their operations. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to see personally standards introduced by the Royal Commission, if I was an ethicist, applied to other industries as well.
So, Michael, we will get to vertical integration because it's certainly coming up in our questions. But just before that, how do you think regulatory interactions will change going forward as a result of this?
I think the regulator's got no choice but to be more pugilistic, if I can employ that term. Perhaps a more neutral term would be active. And not that I'm saying they have not been active, but I think this is a mandate for the regulators absolutely to exercise more and different types of enforcement outcomes. I think at the same time it's really easy to be critical of the regulators, but I for one do not subscribe to that view. I think the regulators have done a good job in terms of the regime at the time, and I think they've got to balance all sorts of things which exist in a very real world, including resourcing, including how to get the best outcomes within a certain time frame. If you're talking about remediation exercises, how can you get an outcome that's going to be favourable to the customer, consistent with an outcome that is going to project the right messages to the industry? Mm-hmm. These are not necessarily easy issues.
Yeah. So, Paul, a question for you, but Michael, I think you want to go there too, is the Royal Commission the end of the big banks' romance with wealth management business?
Well, I mean, we're already seeing a trend here, right? And this was outside of the RC, of a number of the big banks divesting elements or parts of their wealth management arms. I think there has been some misreporting of the nature of what has been divested. You read some headlines saying, I'm not going to name names because I'll get in trouble. I can see a few of my partners in the audience. So it's saying XYZ Bank exits wealth, but in fact they've retained large elements of that wealth business but have sold, componentry of it. I think we'll see that continuing, that continuing pace of divestment of elements of those businesses. But, we also have seen banks exit other areas. The interesting question, I think, is where is the RC going to head to on vertical integration as a whole, and what does that mean, where will policymakers get to? And this is one of those points what I wanted to say around unintended consequences and be careful for what you wish for, because there are a large number of industry funds today who have railed against vertical integration for a long time, who are now vertically integrated businesses themselves, and have actually, have more similar characteristics in terms of the structure of their businesses to the retail funds than they did certainly 10 years prior. Now, the question is, well, what does that do to those arms? I am sceptical about the view that structural separation of, say, a manufacturer and an advisor is by itself going to lead to better advisor outcomes. Not that I want to agree with Anthony too much, but I do actually think this is more of a question of ethics, and it's actually a question of the way in which we treat that advisor, business and other technology solutions there. But I don't think that we will see the current structure of the wealth management industry remain the same into the next decade. I don't think anyone in the industry thinks that's going to be the case. And we are going to see further consolidation. And, of course, I think we'll see if the RC continues down the track it is, recommendations certainly around parts of that separation, who knows how far they'll go. And I think it'll be very, very hard for policymakers not to enact that type of recommendation.
Michael, your thoughts?
I think vertical integration has become charged as a phrase now. Emotionally, and I think that I agree. I think that I think ultimately vertical integration has been seen as one incarnation of many of something that has gone wrong, without necessarily understanding that there are multiple types of vertical integration, and this is one type of vertical integration which incidentally has been affected by market forces, obviously, and market forces have impacted on vertical integration in terms of disposals by the banks. So the romance that has occurred with wealth management has happened for other reasons. Sorry, the romance or the ending of the romance has occurred for other reasons. Whether bank assurance was a failed experiment, I'll let other people judge that. But I don't think that you should assume that getting rid of one vertical integration model is not going to mean that there'll be other types of vertical integration model.
Yeah. I just encourage you to keep answering or sending in your questions, and also to fill in the poll, because I think we'll bring that up soon. But in the meantime, Paul, what do you think the Royal Commission will focus on for industry funds or the superannuation industry in general?
Well, you know, the terms of reference are pretty clear around the focus on trustee company payments to related entities and obviously to sponsoring organisations. I think you'll already see a number of industry funds probably preempt the logical conclusions of that, which is to create new policies and transparency around those payments. I think there is a lot of hype around what that is, and in fact, some people will be very disappointed when the truth comes out, because it isn't at the scale that certainly some people have articulated that it is. What will be interesting, I think, is to see whether the Commissioner applies the same lens in terms of customer expectations, member expectations, and community expectations, and structural findings around industry funds. I don't know that the Commission will go there. What we've seen to date, and I think you touched on it before, is that most of the issues that have been aired by the Commission have been things that are already known within the industry or being dealt with, in terms of some form of inquiry, but haven't been presented to the public in such a condensed and sensational manner.
Yeah.
But we are seeing the Commission kind of light touch over these themes very quickly, very different to, say, the Hayden Commission, which delved right into institutions for very long periods of time. And if they adopt that same approach with industry funds and stick to just what the terms say, I'm not sure that it will be a large process. If they apply the same lens onto as they have to the retail banks, then I think that there'll be some really interesting outcomes around that.
Michael, life insurance, what do you think is coming?
Well, life insurance, a lot of the momentum for the Commission is based on real live events, as we know.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got things, the genesis in things like ASIC review of the life insurance, medical definitions, things like that. So I think you'd anticipate that there's certainly a segment of activity will be around the same sorts of concepts around perceived consumer detriment.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe on claims, it may be on definitions, although the mandate of the Commission is not to duplicate what's come previously. But you can't help but think that there is a very, with life insurance itself, there's a very, very human component to it, more so than in other areas, because life insurance impacts on people's well-being. So I think you'll see some of those issues re-examined. I think mental health, any discussion of life insurance would be incomplete without talking about some of the more difficult areas of coverage, such as mental health. We've already seen activity in the budget in terms of some of the issues around cohorts, generational cover and charging. So I suspect that there's going to be more around that as well. I think it's interesting, though, that we forget sometimes that the word commission is used in two senses. The good lens might say we've got a Royal Commission, and yet going back to my concept of emotional charged expressions, commission has got a very other bad connotation, which is in terms of fees, etc. So one of the issues that's already been articulated is whether the change that came in under LIF in relation to protected commissions would survive, commission surviving the other commission being the Royal Commission.
Mm-hmm. Anthony, I guess I'd like to bring it back a bit to the incentives. Is it possible to get incentives bonus? And this was we did ask our panellists to come up with questions they'd like to ask each other. So this was, is it possible to get incentives, bonuses and KPIs right? Or should we go back to relying mainly on intrinsic motivations? And I think this is one of our polling questions
isn't it? Yeah, and that's it's a leading question. So all the research shows that intrinsic motivation is more important than extrinsic motivation.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if you enjoy your job, you'll do the job properly. If you're paid to do it, if you're paid to do a part of it, you will focus on the part that you will do, and in all likelihood, you probably will enjoy the whole thing less. So that's if we think about... anyone disagree with that? Anyone working... Sorry, I asked this, it's a dangerous thing. I mean, if you want to, you work only for your... You only work for your salary at the end and only for the KPIs. Absolutely not. So the economists say incentives matter. The response is, yes, incentives matter. Incentives matter hugely But they focus you so narrowly that you're not going to do your job properly. So I think incentives are not really helpful to say, if you do this, I'll pay you a lot. Rather, if you want a bonus, you say, you've done the job well. You've picked up this thing we never thought about. Here's an extra whatever it is.
Yeah.
But the idea of incentivizing just does not work.
Mm-hmm. So maybe we can bring up that polling question actually up on the screen, the people at the back, if that would be good, and we'll see where people are at with that. I'm not sure whether it's polling question one or two, but if you can bring it up.
Can I make a comment on that?
Yeah, please.
Which is, I think in this kind of debate, it becomes polarized, and people, I'm not saying Anthony has done this, but I think people, there's a natural inclination to assume that the interests of the customer and the interests of the financial institutions are totally divergent.
Yeah.
Whereas I think we are looking at an alignment, better alignment of the interests of both. So ways in which that's been achieved in other areas of the financial services segment is to share upside, performance fees and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure that it's as stark as simply saying we need to ban incentives.
Yeah.
We need to work to incentives that can better fuel the two sides,
yeah,
better service the two sides.
And that seems to be what I think our surveys here are saying. So we're saying, is it possible to get incentive bonuses and KPIs right? So 62% say yes, 38% say no. But yeah, look, certainly in this audience we know the difficulty sometimes in measuring things, and some things are easier to measure than others.
Yeah.
And it's the other things can be just
as important.
Can I
answer that top question?
Please. So this top question is, in what pub is it okay to charge fee for no services?
I love that question because it shows that actors have a sense of humour. I just want, and I think the answer is probably the Newport Arms, but sorry, doing it from the Northern Beaches, but look, I just want to come back to that point though, around because I think it's a nice way to put it.
Yeah.
But it is this thing about pub tests and community expectations, I think, is really important for us to get right.
Yeah.
And as an industry, it's what has got wrong, right? And the point that I was trying to make, obviously poorly, was that I think within a number of institutions, there has been a tendency to move towards groupthink and echo chambers.
Yeah.
And where people say that this feels okay, without that understanding of where the community is. And that's what I'm talking about, where I think just having a blanket statement about community expectations is so dangerous, because your community, this might be okay, but in that wider community, it is completely out of acceptability. And I feel that some of the cultural reasons why some institutions have got themselves in the trouble they are now is because of that lack of understanding that the community that they are in does not represent that broader community out there.
Mm-hmm.
I think fee for no service too is an interesting example of a charged expression, emotionally emotive, in the sense that fee for no service captured at least three or four different scenarios.
Mm.
Some clearly at one end of the spectrum when people were dead and being charged, absolutely, orphan clients, but it also captured what is loosely regarded as, and apologies to any people who are in the gymnasium industry, but a fee for accessibility. And it became an interesting dichotomy between a legal standard, which was you could charge a fee if people had access to the service, to then a quite negative view, well, that's actually not community expectations. And yet that basic legal contractual model exists in a whole range of industries. I'm not passing no moral judgment either way as to whether that's a good thing or a bad thing for the financial service industry, but it has to be understood in a context.
Yeah.
In a context.
Yeah.
I'd like to go back to this groupthink idea, because I find it very interesting. And I guess it's this thing in organisations. How much is groupthink responsible for the issues that have been uncovered? So in other words, no one really is bothering to consider whether products are in consumer interest. They've been sold for so long, everybody's busy, they don't have the time to actually think. And of course, the other big thing is the disadvantage of moving from the pack. If that's what's done out there, what role? So I guess, what advice are you giving to your clients on some of these issues to really take the time to relook at what they do?
Can I just say community think is interesting, because I look at the board out there which has got a survey about budgetary changes in relation to group insurance, and whilst there may be more in the negative than in the positive, it's interesting to contrast the examples. For every example that says, you know, it's a bad thing because people are being charged, there's another community evaluation that says, what about a person who actually
yeah.
is under 25 and actually dies? Bad outcome, I think, whoever wrote that. I can relate to that, having a relative who passed away at that sort of age. So community.
Complicated.
Yeah, well, community expectations and think is, these are complex issues. I do think, though, that a focal point of the Royal Commission is to actually, and indeed of the APRA culture review, is to challenge some of that. And that's a good thing in many ways. But again, it happens periodically through cyclical events. And just as the agricultural collapses in WA led to further rigour in relation to selling of products, it's inevitable there's going to be a certain action and reaction.
Mm-hmm. And I think that whole notion of first mover disadvantage is probably the first thing that needs to be thrown out of the boardrooms. I mean, that's the lesson of how these institutions got themselves into this state. You know, that fear of first mover disadvantage, I think, has led to numerous practices continuing to occur, even when those involved in either managing those practices or executing those practices knew that it was the wrong thing to do. And that's where I think this commercial imperative needs to come. And I think, you know, insurance in super is a great example of this. Now, I believe one of the great unintended but positive consequences of the design of our occupational superannuation system is the application of new universal life and TPD coverage for our workforce who are members of retail and profit for member funds. I think that has been a net positive for our society, and it has gone some way to address the underinsurance that exists in our society. And when I was a union official and a rank and file union official, you could see the real impact that coverage would have on the lives of workers when they were dealing with either significant workplace trauma or, unfortunately, fatality. Throwing the baby out with the bathwater, I think, has been an example of the industry not moving fast enough to rectify the issues that exist there in the first place. The ISWG was a good process that occurred, but it should have happened 10 years ago. The industry should have come together 10 years ago and rectified this issue for themselves before we get knee-jerk policy reactions to deal with something which does have a misalignment of community expectations of what's occurring. And that has got to be the key lesson out of the RC, in my mind, is that, and this is across industries, right, and the Edelman research shows this in terms of trust barometers and so on, there is a fundamental broken part between community trust and our large corporates. The way that large corporates will rebuild that, in my mind, is by acting themselves and acting before change is imposed upon them.
So, question, yeah, exactly. How do you go about rebuilding trust in boards and senior management? Maybe I can throw that to you, Anthony, first, and just in the whole industry.
I don't think we trust people because we can see that there's this huge overpayments. The people, I mean, I think the applause was largely for the cut the CEO's salary. We really do need to, it's not going to be more of the same. We've got to change our governance structures. And we need more diversity on boards. We need the people. Sorry, I've been on boards of directors, and I've had the argument with CEOs about their salary. If the CEO has asked you to sit on that board, and it comes to discuss his salary, are you going to tell him he's overpaid? And I can't see you can. You've got to be extraordinarily ballsy or robust or foolish to do that. We've got to find ways of splitting these companies up, putting diverse boards on that pull the people down to the level where they actually believe they're doing a job for the clients, not maximizing salary maximizing shareholder income. Research shows the Anglophone world is unique in thinking that we have a moral duty to support the shareholders. Very interesting talk by Mervyn King, South African judge who's head of the Global Integrated Reporting Initiative, saying that what the corporate law allows us to do what he calls lawful wrongs. So you're quite okay to pollute the atmosphere, to exploit a local community, to overcharge your clients, to sell junk contracts, because you have this moral obligation to the shareholders. He says, if that is the case, we've got to change, effectively, as I read it, we've got to change corporate law. We've got to change corporate law so that the shareholders are just one of many stakeholders. They're part of the community. You've got to balance. Now, I've said this to CEOs, and they said, oh, no, but, you know, you need just one or two incentives. You people can't deal with the whole world. And I wonder, you know, I mean, do they cook? Or do they produce the beans 2 hours before, before the roast arrives out? Yeah, everyone can cope everyone multitask, because that's the reality of life. And we've got to see the whole spectrum, not just these single details and think. And look, I mean, I agree, absolutely, there's a continuum and these things are complicated, etc. But because they're complicated, we can't go for silver bullets. Mm-hmm. And we've got to bring everyone on board. Everyone in this room, everyone out there has got a contribution to make to the society generally. And until we do that, and we rely on regulators to punish and the CEOs to magically create wealth, we're getting nowhere and we're going to become more and more distrusting of each other.
So, Michael, what do you think?
I think it's about clarity of thinking and clarity of roles and accountability. And I think all the things Anthony said about board are right, but I think it's ultimately for us, as well, certainly in the legal community, we think it's about identifying with more precision the risk culture aspects that need to be focused on, and you need to restore trust by making institutions realise that a preventative dollar spent is as good as or better than a investment dollar spent in other activities. So I think one of the lessons of the Royal Commission is that preventative dollars spent on risk management and risk culture are good dollars to spend.
Yeah, I also think absolutely, and I reckon this is also this point around social license. You know, we have a real disconnect around the social license that a number of these institutions have to operate. Now, I don't agree with with answers like of breaking it up, because I don't know what that means, right? So we're going to legislate that you can no longer have more than what is the cutoff point? 250,000 customers.
Glass-Steagall.
I mean, are we going to legislate? And what changes does that lead to? I mean, the ultimate point that I think we need to come back to around here is how do we get these industries, and it is multiple industries outside of FS, to reconnect that level of trust that needs to be brought back. And I do not believe that this is going to come through a regulatory outcome. I think we are seeing this actually come through technology and through disruption that is occurring across industry at the moment, that is empowering customers to exercise more greater levels of choice, which agile organisations, I think, are responding to by recognising it actually makes sound commercial sense to put your customers and your clients first, that, in fact, you can actually do more than one thing at once and do both elements there. But my strong view is that your point is spot on the money, that this previous approach, that risk function, that in many institutions, social license function, are cost centres or profit inhibitors, is that fundamental shift that needs to change, and the kind of validation of the value of those functions and those philosophies in these institutions going forward is how these institutions will transform through that space.
Yeah. I think also it's important that we have this discussion in stereo and not in mono, because in stereo there are plenty of examples of bad behaviour. There are plenty of examples of very good behaviour,
yes,
compassionate,
yeah,
institutions. And I think if you lose that part of the narrative, then that's not a great thing in terms of the trust equation.
And this is one of the difficulties at the moment, isn't it? Because we're focusing on where it all went wrong rather than focusing on the positives. And just in that sense, what are the international reputational risks, obviously, for the Australian financial industry? Obviously, we raise capital. Is it a lasting stain, a confidence the system will be, you know, efficiently reformed? Where do you think, what are our international counterparts looking at the Australian financial services and thinking?
Well, they're investing in the life insurance market, which our local people don't think is worthwhile, which I find quite interesting. Yeah, sorry, that's I mean, that's a red herring. I wouldn't go for that.
I mean, I think they are. They're trying to make sense of it, as we all are, of where it's going to land. They're looking at vertical integration. They're looking at what's going to happen to distribution and manufacturing, and they're trying to piece all those bits of the puzzle together. They're looking at class actions, and they're saying, are those realistic anchors on the businesses here, or are they more spontaneous knee-jerk reactions to certain things? So I think everyone is trying to make sense of that, of the board game, which is the whole industry at the moment, and trying to work out, you know, how these things all fit together. But I think there are some forces of change that can be recognised. I think the fact that there'll be certain payments cut off for the advisory distribution arms must mean that there's got to be some change to those types of businesses, for example.
I think the trust element as well is, I mean, this is not a unique Australian phenomenon.
No.
You know, like, and of course, we're seeing that in terms of the carbon copy approach that we have from some in terms of regulation coming here from other jurisdictions. But this is a issue. The root causes that we've been dealing with that led to the RC, you know, is a global issue, particularly in the developed world, and I agree, particularly in the Anglophile world, where I think these issues have been accentuated because of the unique nature of the structures that exist there.
Mm-hmm. Anthony, which question did you want to pick?
Unintended consequences.
What were the unintended consequences seen today from the Royal Commission from panellists' views?
Well, none so far in terms of recommendations, but yeah. I think from a government point of view, political point of view, the unintended consequence was something that was meant to deal with this issue and get it off the front page, just put it back on the front page.
Speaking to my lawyer colleagues at UNSW, their concern is that we'll get more regulation. I think that's, Michael, your concern. And I think that would be a very, very bad result. So in South Africa, when I started my career, the Pension Fund Act 1956 had 24 pages. I was somewhat surprised to come here and discover that the SIS Act has 1,000 pages and there are 1,000 pages of regulation. They're also, and then APRA has been adding it at a huge rate over the last little while. So if you take the idea, standards are community standards, and they need to speak to us, our good spirits. The research shows that when we have these standards repeated to us, we are more likely to respond positively. When the law tells you exactly what to do, who is responsible? You or the law? Well, the law. And it doesn't work that way. It just cannot work that way. It cannot enforce the law. 2,500 years ago, what? Jeremiah. I will put the law on their hearts. You read John Braith. If you don't like Jeremiah the prophet, try John Braithwaite, the Australian academic. He talks about regulation. He says you've got to have responsive regulation at the bottom of the pyramid. For 90% of the people, you've got to be on their side. You've got to be bringing them along with you. It's got to be self-regulation. Right at the top of the pyramid, you've got to carry a big stick for the really problem things. And because we haven't had the big stick, and that would be my question to Michael later, why haven't we had the big stick? Trust has been reduced. But the regulations are the problem. I've read them. I would say what would really be good to come out of the Royal Commission is to abolish the SIS Act and the regulations. Just abolish them completely. Start again. Take 20 minutes to write up some tax rules. Take the FSRA, the Financial Services Reform Act of 2001, added 180,000 words to the Corps Act. Take it out completely. I mean, we know 75% of after, what's it, 15 years of regulation, 75% of financial advice doesn't conform to what was there. So have we made progress on the other 25%? I doubt.
Let me ask Paul and Michael quickly, because we're coming to the end of time. So what do you think will be the long-lasting impact of this commission?
Well, I like Anthony's thinking, but I've never seen a Royal Commission that has ever recommended less regulation. and of course, it's important to remember the Royal Commissions are a bit like Productivity Commission reports. There is reams and reams of paper that sits in some big warehouse somewhere in Canberra of recommendations that often never even see a parliamentary drafting office, sorry, I'm liking some of these questions coming up at the moment. any substantive change in that. But I think the long lasting implication of this is that hopefully these institutions will recognise that only fundamental and seismic change is going to actually re-establish that trust in the long term, and that window dressing will not get there.
Mm-hmm. But for me, I think it's stricter enforcement, more regulation, and the pendulum swinging more that way inevitably. I think, just going back briefly to the unintended consequence, I'm not sure it's unintended, but I think the way in which trust is rebuilt has to, the Royal Commission has a certain influence on that, and I think it's not the role of the Commission, but I think if you're getting a report card and you're getting failure, 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 and you're not getting any sense of, and I'm not saying it's the role of the Commission, but there's no countervailing kind of credit on your report card, I think one of the consequences is that people in financial institutions, the morale of those people, really good people, is ebbing. And I think as an industry we have to support people who have been hardworking, and I mean that's not a kind of bland statement. I think it's a really important part of that trust equation. We've got to recognise that the pendulum has swung this way. Trust will be built by more measure, presumably more conviction in the community that these things are going to be addressed, and more exhibition of good behaviour coming as well.
Mm-hmm. And just plain good conversations, I think, between society and financial services about actually why the products exist in the first place, but how we can do better in working it out. Yeah. Look, Michael wins the best tie of the conference, by the way, someone just pointed out.
That was certainly
out. Look, time has run out, but I think you'll all agree it's really been fascinating, even though, unfortunately, we do have to close this session. So please join me in thanking Michael, Paul and Anthony. Thanks very much. Thank you.